fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.
Aujourd'hui, je rencontre Andrea Damascelli, physicien quantique au département de physique et d'astronomie de British Columbia University à Vancouver et directeur scientifique du Stuart Blossom Quantum Matter Institute de cette même université. Andrea nous amène à l'intérieur de son laboratoire et nous guide parmi les machines remarquables avec lesquelles il travaille, des instruments capables de générer des impulsions de lumière d'une précision extrême pour sonder les matériaux et révéler le comportement étrange de la matière quantique. L'épisode se conclut par un poème inspiré de cette rencontre.
So, yeah, the laser light a very specific color. So if you look, this is a laser system, but then of course a very complicated laser system. It's not like, you know, your laser pointer that makes one the red light. Or, but here we start off, you have to be careful because it's a little dangerous, so we don't have to go down, but you see the green light is what a commercial laser gives it for us. Mm-hmm. It's a very clean single frequency, so green. Usually, you know, lasers can work in the infrared to visible, and this starts off as green. It's called Verdi, because Verdi Italian means green, and this is made by Coherent, which is a famous company. But you see now there on those mirrors, there is some blue light. And the blue light is where we do a conversion from the green into a higher frequency, so it basically means changing color. And so we're pushing this thing from the visible into the ultraviolet. So we go to the blue, to the violet, and then to the ultraviolet. So now this is what we do here. So we generate very high frequency light. And in that laser there, which is even more complicated, this was built by colleagues here, David Jones and Art Mills. David is another faculty member here. So here we go extreme ultraviolet. So now there's not very much you can see here because the laser is all covered. It's really under those boxes, there is all kind of optical elements, mirror lenses, or amplifiers, all kind of things. So now go and generate really high frequencies. Eventually you can go in the X-ray with a laser, but we use that light. And so generating light is what certainly fascinated me as a student. And at that time I wanted to be building lasers. Okay. But then things went a little sideways. I was supposed to work on a project in Italy, but that project got cut because of funding issues. And so I was supposed to build, it's always sticking, I was supposed to build a laser for medical applications. To keep it with those things. But then the project was cut, so I couldn't do it. And then I found another project, which was in Florence, not in Milan, where I studied. But in Florence, there is a famous lab, which is where Galileo did his work. And so there is a famous optics lab. And in fact, it's called LENS, LENS means lens as a lens, but actually means the European Laboratory for Nonlinear Spectroscopy. So it was a European-funded effort. It was on top of the hill where Galileo department actually used to be. And so then I went there to do an experiment. We use lasers now to study materials. And so that is, you know, laser light is generated by manipulating materials. You can build a medium that becomes optically active and generate light of a specific color. But so that light goes to be absorbed. So this is what we call light-matter interaction. And so we can now use the laser. Not only we can generate with material, but we can use it to study materials. And so that's what I started to do. I started studying materials with laser light. And so that becomes even more interesting to me. And so that was the path. And in fact, if we look at the kind of experiments I'm going to tell you in a moment here, this is based on an effect which is called the photoelectric effect, which is you shine light on a solid, that light or the individual particle of light, which are called photons, that single photon will be absorbed by an electron, which is the individual particle of charge in the material, and the electron can get emitted. So this is an experiment that was done at the end of the 1800s by German physicist Hertz, and then was explained by Einstein. And that's how Einstein won the Nobel Prize. And so that particular experiment, when Einstein came up with his intuition for what was going on, is a demonstration of the quantum nature of light, light being made of photons, but also the quantum nature of matter, having electrons in a solid, so quantization of charge, which occupy quantize energy levels. So it cannot be just any random energy, but it's very specific levels that the electron occupies. And so that explanation was the beginning of quantum. Well, it's one of the phenomena, not the only one, but one of the phenomena which basically marks the beginning of quantum science. And eventually, that was, at that time, people didn't know what an electron was, what a photon was. There was no knowledge of this kind of thing. So these were conjectures, but then they had been demonstrated experimentally. And they went from, in the 1900, early 1900 being the beginning of quantum science to now become a technology which is used in industry, because extracting an electron from a solid, you can actually tell from what element it came from. So if you want to know, you have a piece of material, you want to know what's in there, sometimes you get jewelers coming here asking, is this gold? How do you tell? Right? We do this experiment and we say, these are the characteristic lines of gold or not. Sometimes, no, it's not. there is a little gold, but not a lot. So in principle, you can do this experiment that way, but we don't use it that way. We already know the material, we already know what's in there. Now the way we use it is to look at what are the electrons which are responsible for the interesting electronic properties doing. So let's say James showed you superconductivity. We have material which is a superconductor, or even we want to know if it's a superconductor, but usually we can figure it out in some other ways, easier way. But now we want to know which electrons are responsible for superconductivity. Now we come here, because now we can extract these electrons, and then we can infer back what was the electron doing in the solid, how fast was it moving, in which direction. And so basically I would say this is a way of visualizing the motion of electrons in solids. And for some material like copper wire and stuff like that, there's not very much to learn anymore. We already know everything. But for things which are showing exotic physical properties, that's what you need to do in order to really come to a microscopic description.
But usually these are elements which are already existing, or you build also these materials?
So these are materials, the most complex materials, where you have many elements in there. And so for instance, copper wire is just copper, single element. Metallic copper, copper is a metal, conducts electricity, but the superconductor we showed you made here are yttrium, barium, copper, oxygen in a very specific composition. And so it's not something you would find, it's not a mineral that you extract. I mean, there is always the possibility that you could get that, but it was not found as a mineral. Copper was found by just digging the ground, right? But it's not a mineral. You make it in a lab. And so nowadays we keep it here. We keep IO as in many other places around the world, but certainly here, we always try to do push material discovery. So new materials that may exhibit completely new properties that could change the world. So this has been done many times and is happening many times. And so now a new material comes up, we go characterize it. There are many tools that you use to characterize it. In QMI we have the usual procedure. We'll say Alana Hallas, we were just in front of her office. She discovers a new material. Her group of students discover a new material. They go look at the transfer of charge or conductivity or so. They figure that it's, or they look at magnetic properties. They figure it's an interesting system for whatever reason. And then we start doing more complicated investigations. So then we use spectroscopy. Spectroscopy means now you look at the energy structure of some protein, the energy dependence of some protein. That's what spectroscopy means. And there are many forms. In QMI, there are many forms. There's optical spectroscopy, there is scanning, the tunneling spectroscopy, which is what Sarah and James do. There is neutron spectroscopy, which is what Alana, or X-ray, which is what Alana is also doing. And then there is photoelectron spectroscopy, which is a combination of light and matter and so on. And so that's how it started. I was fascinated by this interaction, the idea that you can generate light, you to manipulate light. And so the field of light generation manipulation since the early days when I was a student has grown tremendously. And so these days, you know, these are not commercial systems. Some parts of those are commercial systems, but you know, an enclosure like this, an optical lit cable like this, is the know-how which has been developed here. And maybe one day we become part of a commercial system. For now, it's not yet.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you look at your early lasers, were huge machines, and then but now you have laser diodes which are microscopic, you can't even see them.
Still looks huge. You know?
This looks huge. So now if you look at a thing like this, you say, why is this so big? Well, the two enclosures are lasers that generate the light. So you need that light. That's a starting point. We can also generate the light with other means, but generating UV light is not that easy. So the tools that we really use in these technologies are vidded lasers, and that's new. It's a new development of the last 10 years. Otherwise, we use electron accelerators, synchrotrons, like the Canadian Light Source, or Soleil, or ESRF in Grenoble. These are places where these are very big rings where you accelerate electrons. And every time, and again from Einstein's work, Einstein's relativity, we know that if you take a charged particle and you accelerate it, which means either you increase the velocity or you change the trajectory, that will generate light. And so now you have electrons going down a ring and you accelerate them, and then we send them through a periodic structure of magnet where these electrons start wiggling like that. And every time they do that, they generate light. And so now we can have synchrotron, let's call synchrotron light. It's very high quality light, very high intensity, and very monochromatic, so very sharp in color, even though it's not visible, because now we go from the visible all the way into the X-ray. And so usually we would use that. So we have built a couple of beam lines that are kind of like source to do these experiments. So there we use the synchrotron light. Here we do it with lasers. And there you have a huge machine that generates the light.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have a laser, which is much smaller, so there are differences. And there is a big difference. The light in the synchrotron is basically almost continuous light, like a light source that we're used to. This one is not. It's very short pulses of light. So very, very short. So short means that we have units that we describe these things. You know, usually we think in terms of minutes, hours, or seconds. Milliseconds. This is femtoseconds. Femtoseconds means, you know, if I write it using mathematical expression, it's 10 to the minus 15 seconds, which means a million of a billion of a second. Okay, so it's a very tiny unit of time, and in fact, it's coming close to, you know, a single cycle of the wave. But so they're very short pulses. And so the advantage or the difference here is that now we can generate very short pulses of light, and we can use this technology to realize what is basically a high-speed camera for electrons. In the early days, you want to take a picture, you wanted to see, you know, a running horse and determine whether or not, you know, the hooves were all coming off at the same time when the horse was running or not. And you couldn't see it because, you know, you didn't have a high-speed camera. So they started working on that. In fact, it was an experiment at Stanford where you basically use, you know, in a way the idea is that you illuminate the horse only for certain moments, you take pictures, and then when you do that, you can see that, yes, the scene is coming off the ground. So now you're doing the same with electrons, but electrons goes quite a bit faster than a horse. So you need a fast camera.
Yeah.
So that's basically the idea. One pulse comes in and excites the electrons in the material. Then the second pulse comes in with a delay and loops, and so it probes the material now, probes the electrons. And so we change the delay. And we are changing the delay, you know, because electrons are moving close to, basically relativistic, close to the speed of light, you need, you know, something equivalent. And so that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with very fast pulses that can look at an electron which is close to the speed of light. And so the technology has been the one of pushing down these lasers so that you can do this kind of stuff. That is the laser part for the synchrotron. In synchrotron, you look at equilibrium. You just look at your material equilibrium. Here, you're looking under excitation. Denver is all that stuff there is the vacuum chamber, because by now I think you've seen a number of vacuum chambers around here. Basically, all these sophisticated spectroscopic techniques require a clean material. And to have a clean material, it means that you have to put it in vacuum and keep it in vacuum, and then you have to generate a clean surface in vacuum, because this technique is very surface sensitive. So if you have any, you know, atmospheric layer attached to the surface, sticking to the surface, you're not going to be able to measure the material. So The way we do it is two ways, basically. Either we make a material inside. This is what Sarah Berg does, for instance, with David Jones. They grow carbon 60. It's called, one of the forms of carbon is this big, large spheres of carbon atoms. And they make a film of these spheres of carbon atoms on gold, and is used to, as an application, this could be for photovoltaics, which is a material that converts light, not in an outgoing electron, but in electricity, right? And so we use it for any kind of application that relies on solar energy. That's the principle there. So they want to study that. So they make it here, and then they transfer it to our chamber without going into atmosphere. So the material remains pristine. That's one way to do it. We do the same next door with KZO. His lab grows all kind of materials in thin film form, and we have a chamber like this on that side. Otherwise, that's what we mostly do. We bring a sample in there, a crystal from Alana, and now we break it in there. And so the surface is now clean. And not only has to be clean, it has to be also atomically perfect. So not every material breaks nicely. So the superconductor that Jane showed you have the property of breaking nicely because they're very two-dimensional, like a book. Mm-hmm. Where you can open the pages and if you get a flat surface. So now it's flat and clean. So now you can do this experiment, you shine light, the electrons come out, and we keep track of the directional motion of those electrons and of their velocity. So now we can know which way they go and how fast. And if you know what they do that outside of the sample, we can use simple laws of physics, energy conservation, momentum conservation, to tell us what was the energy inside and how fast is it moving and in which direction. That's as simple as that. You know, it's one of the most elegant, to my ear, it looks like one of the most elegant spectroscopy you can do. Because, yes, it's quantum in nature, but that's the same you do with billiard ball. You know, you kick a ball and the ball will go in a certain direction conserving energy and momentum. And that's exactly what we do here. However, it's not a ball, it's an electron, so it's also a wave. So that's where it gets interesting. And it's quantum, so what a billiard ball is not. You can do it whatever energy, whatever velocity, whatever direction. Not the case here. Okay, they're all quantized. So only certain. So it's that interesting sort of duality, if you like, where the real physics is quantum mechanical in nature, but often you can sort of try to develop an intuition, which to some degree relies on general laws of physics, which are valid also for classical physics, so also for the world that we see and we experience with our eyes. So that's why I was fascinated with this technique. I didn't start right away with this. I started with spectroscopy in the time domain as a student, using this delay stuff. Then I went into optical spectroscopy, which is a bit of a simpler way of looking at things. But then really I wanted to use this technique where you extract the electrons out, because you can really get to, you know, the characteristic, define quantities that define the quantum nature of these materials. So you really need those, and so that's what fascinated me.
But of all kind of materials in theory?
It works for all kind of materials. I mean, the principle is valid for all kind of materials. Of course, here we study, you know, again, we study new materials, and then we all as physicists develop an expertise, you know, like a chemist. So my expertise is more in a certain class of materials, driven by the curiosity. So high temperature superconductivity was one case, or some exotic form of magnetism. So I ended up working a lot on, and I'm still working a lot on, transition metal oxide. So materials that bring together the transition metals. There are, if you look at the periodic table, there are three rows of transition metals. And so I started out with the first row, which is perhaps one of the most interesting, and then moving, like copper is in that row, but then moving down to the second row, which is where ruthenium and rhodium are, and then going down to the third row, where iridium is, so an osmium. So this system, as you move across the periodic table, is like exploring, you know, the world and finding new properties and new behaviors. So they change, but there is, not randomly, they change in a way that we now understand, and we try to develop an understanding, and it's quite interesting. And so oxygen is interesting, because when you put together this transition method with oxygen is an element that does favor the propagation of electrons in solid. Transition metals instead want to have their electrons very localized. So you have this complication between electrons wanting to be free to move, like in a metal, or localized, like in a magnet. And so when you have this competition, like when you have frustration, the frustrated icosahedron, that's where new physics can come out. And so by tuning very finely, the parameter of the material, now you can express more one property versus another, and that's where you find all these new states of matter which are interesting. So that's what we are still working on, is systems where you play the competition between different interactions, between different, you know, tendency of the electrons, so as to find new physics. And then over time, of course, you know, now going from crystal to two-dimensional materials, so reducing dimensionality, or even one-dimensional, it's another way of playing these competitions and expressing new properties, and so, or putting together two layers of dissimilar material and then twisting them. So these are all the new developments of the last 10 years. And so we're trying to do all of that. So now the complexity is mostly to give you vacuum for this system, give you this column that you see here is the manipulator. The sample is going to sit on at the end of this. Now the sample is down there, but we cannot look down because the laser light is coming. So the red light means that the laser is on. And so there is light on the sample. So here it could be laser light reflected, which is fine for us, but it's dangerous for the eyes. So we don't want to accidentally get a reflection of our eyes. So the sample now is at the end of a column which is inside, which is what we call the cryogenic manipulator. Basically, it's a way of holding a sample in vacuum, be able to move it and cool it down at liquid helium temperature. So this instrument has all been built here. This is a technology that we developed here, how to do that in vacuum, how to cool down such low temperatures and be able to move it. Sample is down there, the light comes in, and then electrons come out. And then we rotate the sample so that we can collect electrons coming out in all directions. So all these tools that you see, all the things sticking out, are ways of manipulating the sample, maybe evaporating a few atoms on the clean sample surface to change the properties, ways of looking at the light that comes in, because now you have two pulses, and they have to go to the same spot on the sample, and then you have to, so basically you need to do, you know, the spatial overlap between the pulses, but then you also have to do the temporal overlap, because they have to come in coincidence, and then you change the delay. So you have to do all of that, and so in order to do that, we use all kinds of tools and tricks to align these things in space and time. So it's quite complex, but the group has developed over the year all the know-how to do that. So if we go around, so the guys are measuring, so they're controlling from here. This is what the instruments are doing, and it's hard to explain what this is, but if you look at an image like that, this is what is being measured now, and then they analyze it here. And you see this line of intensity. This is what the analyzer, the system measured. This is an image which has energy, so kinetic energy, velocity of the electron, and the direction of motion. Now it's taking another image. So it's basically taking multiple images and changing angle, something like that, or delays. I don't know exactly what it's changing right now. And the line is basically, it's telling you that there is no electron up here. And that's because when we put electrons in a solid, it's like filling a bucket with water. The electron wants to go down to the lowest energy state, which we call the ground state. And then if you have more electrons, because they cannot be all at the same level, this is quantum mechanics, there are some rules on how you fill in an atomic structure, because two electrons cannot have the same quantum numbers, that's what we say. It's basically Pauli-Susum principle. You start off from the bottom, and then you start filling up, up to this level. This is what we call the Fermi level. There's no more electron out there. And so now we come in with a photon, we can only remove electron from below, because there's nothing above. And now you see that the intensity is not the same everywhere. There is a line. So really the electrons are distributed here. There is a certain relation between the energy of the electron and the direction of motion. So if you're moving in this direction, that's the energy the thing will have. If you're moving in a slightly different direction, the electron has a lower energy. So that is basically telling us about the electronic structure. So this picture, when I saw it the first time, for me was a miracle, because these are things we can calculate. But in the old days, to see this would have been a very painful experiment. First you measure this direction, then you measure this one. It would have taken forever. But now in a moment, you can see how fast it is. It's just, it's like taking pictures.
Crazy.
You can't use a cell phone to do it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's big. That's the only difference. But these are pictures of electrons moving. So by looking at this line, the slope of the line, I know that tells me the velocity. So the slope of the line is called the Fermi velocity. From Fermi, because Fermi study, Italian physics study all of the behavior of electrons close to the highest kinetic energies. This is called the group of these electrons, the ensemble of these electrons, called the Fermi C. Because these electrons are moving like almost like independent particles, like an ideal gas or particle. Mm-hmm. So this was called the Fermi liquid. And so, because it's like a liquid of particles which are not strongly interacting, it's electrons. And so then it's called, also referred to, the ensemble is referred to as the Fermi sheaf. And this is the Fermi velocity. So the slope is directly the velocity. So each material will have a characteristic velocity. And depending on what you want to see, you may want to look for materials at very high velocity, so very steep line, or very low velocity, very flat line. So, and the properties change. Mm-hmm. And in fact, before I was telling you, the electron wants to be localized, the mm-hmm. line goes down, no velocity. The electron wants to, and it becomes magnetic. Mm-hmm. The electron wants to, and maybe supernova. Mm-hmm. The electron wants to be free to move, high velocity, copper. Not much interesting in physics, you know? So that's basically, just by looking at it, we can say, okay. This is the kind of behavior. So, but if we go around this way, be careful because we have a sharp end. So now you see the other side. So light is coming over the mirrors and it's going in. What we do here, not only we get the lighting, but we reduce it to a very small spot size. So now we can look at very small materials. So for instance, if we exfoliate, like people like to do exfoliating graphite to make graphene, these monatomic layers. The problem is when you exfoliate, and we exfoliate in vacuum, you get very small samples. So now you need a small spot to look at it. Otherwise you collect stuff from all around and you can see it, what you want to see. So here we realize what is a very small spot of light onto the sample. This object here is the electron analyzer. So this is, now the sample is there, the light is coming in from the two lasers, here it's traveling in air, there it travels in vacuum, comes in, they go on the sample, and the electrons are coming out in this direction. And so they go into this hemisphere. In the hemisphere, there are two hemispheres, and the electron has to travel in between. And so now what these electrons are seeing is an electric field. So if you have a volume of space where there is a field going this way, the electron will come in, and because the electron is a charged particle and there is an electric field, it will be deflected. Now, the very fast electron booms and shoots through and doesn't change direction, but the slow electron will drift. And so by having a field in there and having all these electrons come in, now we distribute them depending on their kinetic energy, their velocity. And that's why you see those pictures. At the end of this process, once they get to the other side, they're all spread out depending on their velocity. And we do that for each directional motion. And so that's as simple as that. You know, the electrons are coming out in all directions. We collect a bunch of them. We run them through this thing. As they get out, all those directions now, that was what we put in, but now they're all spread out in energy and velocity because the field did the job of spreading them out. So then we collect it. Another collection thing is, or should I touch it? The collection thing is, it's similar to basically night vision goggles. You know, you have electrons come in, then there is a device that turns this electron in photons and multiplies them. So each electron generates a bunch of photons, then these photons get multiplied, and then they go through a window, they first go onto a phosphor screen. Phosphor screen now, let me rephrase. This works this way. Electrons come in, they punch, go into the device, and by hitting the device, they get more electrons out. And then this, you know, basically multiply the electrons through an avalanche process, it's called. So now those electrons go onto a phosphor screen, and now you basically stimulate fluorescence, so you convert the electrons that you can't see into a green screen.
Echo Lalia. I sit here in the rings I can't cast, watching you grow crystal, yellow green. Crystal, green, crystal, blue green, very monochromatic light, hidden in aluminium foil. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme.
Grammaire Fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.
Thank you.